please join me in giving a warm welcome to Erica McKenzie.
Thank you so much, Jeff and Ions, and everybody for coming. My voice is a little hoarse. I'll do my best, and sometimes I talk a little fast. That's my Italian grandma. Let's just get started. I want to set the table tonight for those of you that probably don't know very much about me, and just to give you a better perspective of who I am. I was raised in Nebraska in a very small farm community, about 1,000 people. And I had 17 kids in my class. The same 17 kids that were in my class were in kindergarten with me all the way through high school. 64 students from 9th grade through 12th total when I was a senior. So it was a really small town. In the town that I grew up in, I'm not sure if you guys have ever experienced anything like this, but I didn't know this wasn't like the norm until I moved away from the country. We had a whistle that would blow at 7 a.m. in the morning for the whole town, and that meant get up, get ready for work, it's time to go. And then at noon every day, the whistle would blow again, and that meant stop doing what you're doing, go home and eat your lunch. We'd have another whistle blow at 6 o'clock at night, and that meant you've done enough for today, go home, recuperate, and come back tomorrow. So these were little things in a small town that I grew accustomed to, sort of like our own little set of rules, if you will. Along with growing up in this really small town was church. And this is an important part I want to describe in the beginning, and I think you'll understand by the time we get to the end. For me, church was going to Wednesday school on Wednesdays after normal school. Then it was on Sunday going to regular church, which was going to your class first with like your little friends and your age group of Sunday school. And then you would go to regular church with your parents and sit. And then I did the youth group and I participated a lot with that. So I did a lot with church every week since I was little until I went away to college. Everybody has family members, right? Well, for me, my family was my mom and my dad, my little sister who was 7 years younger, Sarah. I knew my mom as Mom. I learned that that was her name, so I called her Mom. My sister was Sarah. I called her Sarah. I wouldn't call her anything else. The same for me was God. I learned the word God because I was taught that from a child and grew this relationship a couple days a week for such a long time. And God was a family member, like my sister and my mom and my dad. And Jesus was God's son. And that's what I learned from a child. So as I'm talking about my story, I just like to set the table and let everyone know a little background of where I come from and what I was raised to learn, and then what happened when I had my near-death experience. As a child, as early as 5 years old, I can remember being able to see, hear, and feel spirit all around me. I thought it was normal. I grew up in a house that I was convinced was haunted. At the time, I thought it was haunted because in my house, it was a really old home, and at one time it had belonged to a doctor who used to see the patients in his home. And I, as a child, would have these people that had crossed over come and visit me at different times, and it was never a bad thing. It was always like I was helping them wherever they were at in their journey. It was just giving them love. So I got really used to it, but it was just like a thing where I kind of thought it was only happening at my house, and I wanted to talk about it, but of course, every time if I would try to bring it up, my parents would kind of shush me and be like, oh, you've been watching too much, you know, movies or whatever. So I didn't really ever get to talk about that, but that is really important because I did see, feel, and hear a lot. Now, the first time I can remember hearing spirit was I was 5 years old in kindergarten. And I was so excited because in kindergarten, we got to learn how to write our letters of the alphabet. And I don't know if any of you people know, maybe it's a Nebraska thing, but we used to have the letter people. It's like this little show that the teacher brings in on an old black and white screen TV, and you get your lesson, it's the letter of the day, and you're going to learn how to write the letter A, for example, the letter people. Well, I was so excited because I was really good at drawing. I loved to draw. I loved to color anything with my hands. I was very creative. And so I loved the writing lessons of the day. I thought, oh my gosh, this is awesome. We're doing the letter A today. I can't wait. And our teacher gave stickers. And so that was even better because stickers were great. So we were having our lesson. for the day, she's going around our little rectangle table, all 17 of us. Oh, you did a great job. Keep it up. You know, I'm going, moving on to the next person. Everybody was getting a sticker, and I was so excited because I felt like I had really worked hard, taken my time, and done a good job. And I was really proud of the work that I did. And I couldn't wait for her to get around to me. And with anticipation, here she comes, and it's my turn next. I can hardly wait. And she stood looking at my work for a long time. She was silent. I thought, this is odd. Well, it's probably because I did so well that she just is, you know, thinking about what sticker that she can give me, because I did that much better than everyone else, I'm sure. She said, Erica, put down your pencil. And I thought, okay, this is awesome. Are you guys ready to see it? I'm telling my class, everybody looking at me. So anyway, what she did, she picked up a ruler. And she began slapping my hands in front of the whole class as hard as she could, both of my hands. And I didn't understand at 5 years old what was going on. I was in shock. Not only that, I looked around the room. These are like my brothers and sisters to this day because we've been through so many years. But everybody was in shock looking because this had never happened before. All my classmates sitting here trying to figure out what's going on. And in that moment, she says to me, Erica, you never write with your left hand. You only write with your right. I honestly didn't even know that I had a left hand and a right hand, and that's what they were called. I just knew I had these things called hands. And what I knew was, with my hands, I could do a lot of amazing things. I mean, amazing things. And then I had the realization, okay, this is really weird, because I was starting to think of everything that I could do well. Everything I could do really well was actually with my left hand. I was thinking about all these really awesome things I could draw at that age, and it was all with my left hand. I couldn't do anything to save my life with my right. And I was a pretty good athlete even at that age, and I could throw at everything. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, it's with my left hand. Oh no, I eat with my left hand. I can't do anything with my right. So I was trying to process what was happening. I looked at everybody in my class again, and at this point, they were all really thankful that their pencil was in the right hand. And I remember taking a mental notation of that, oh my gosh, I am the only one that writes with this hand over here. It's so weird. So this is really important, because this really set the table at 5 years old on my perception that different, for whatever reason, is not okay, wasn't acceptable. And at 5 years old, that didn't make sense to me. I was trying to hold back my tears when that happened, and a tear rolled down my cheek. I just couldn't, because I couldn't understand it. I felt desperate. I knew my class could not help me. I was alone. And in that very moment, that's the very first time that I heard Spirit. Not only did I hear Spirit, I was very clear at 5 years old that it was God's voice. It was the voice of this Spirit that I was growing a connection to at such a young age. And that connection, God was the only one there for me in that moment. And the voice said, Erica, I love you. I made your left hand. And I remember knowing to look all around the room again at my classmates again. And God said, Erica, I love all of them too. And I made their right hand. And I knew in that moment that it wasn't God that was saying that our differences are bad. This is not okay. It was man. It didn't come from God at all. And actually, our differences, not only beautiful and essential, they were important. They were extremely important. Each and every one of us have differences that were important. So that was the lesson that day in kindergarten to chew off. And that, again, set the table for the next several years until middle school. I was so thankful that I had this new best friend, this connection I was growing with God, because God was there for me. And I knew, because he let me know that day, that our differences were awesome and beautiful. So what I proceeded to do is, the next several years, I went through grade school looking at everybody, that it was so awesome that we were different. How cool is this? I remember Shane Martin, God love him to this day, I would rub Shane Martin's head. You know why? Why do you think I would go and rub Shane Martin's head all the time? One of my classmates. Any guesses?
He's bald.
Well, he is today, but years ago... But years ago, I would rub his head because Shane was the smartest kid in our class. I'm not even kidding you, like, he knew it all. He was so amazing. And to me, I had a learning disability. learning was so hard for me. And I thought, this is so cool. Like, where is it coming from? It just comes out and it's right with Shane. And so, like, I would rub his head thinking that maybe something would rub off on me. I don't know. But I did it for years, and he humbled me, and he actually tutored me sometimes. He was such a great guy. But I thought, gosh, Shane's gift. You know, I don't have that gift. But that is an awesome gift. And I would look at other classmates and other kids at my school, and there was like some amazing athletes, for example. And I thought, that is so cool. Gosh, I wish I could like make a touchdown and like run faster. Nobody could catch me. I think it's so awesome. Good for them. There were so many neat, beautiful, different things. Good listeners, people that were just always there to help. There was all kinds of awesome things. But the important thing is, I knew we were all different. It was great. And I also noticed something else. When we were little, it was a beautiful thing because most of us knew that we were different and it was awesome too. We loved it. Well, you guys can probably guess what happened in middle school. Well, at least this is what happened to me. By the time I was 12 years old in seventh grade, I came back from summer ready to start my junior high experience. And something happened. All these people that I knew for such a long time, puberty. I don't know what else you want to call it, but we'll go with that. People changed in a big way. When different used to be okay and was accepted and it was exciting and we empowered each other, overnight, all of a sudden, it wasn't okay. You didn't fit in. You didn't belong. You weren't good enough. There was cliques. It was foreign. I didn't get it. I didn't understand. Because I kept remembering my kindergarten lesson just as though it happened like the day before. I couldn't get that burned out of my memory. And I knew that that was wrong. I started to see it happening a lot. I started to see bullying. Kids getting left out because they were nerds, because they were smart. It didn't make sense. There was all kinds of things. And I wasn't exempt. It started happening to me too. I would have girls that would tell me I was fat, or tell me that I didn't have probably the right clothes to wear. I was Italian, and I've always had, you know, a lot of hair. And they would call me things like bush monster. They were nice to my face one day and mean behind my back, those kind of things. It was a big variety of things, but there was a lot of stuff going on, and it was really sad because to me, I knew it wasn't right. I knew it wasn't okay, and I didn't want any part of it, but I didn't know how to stop it. I didn't talk to people like that. I didn't treat them like that. I did the best I could to embrace everyone, but it didn't matter. It kept happening, and it kept happening to me. And so what I ended up doing to cope with that problem is Erica took it out on herself. I couldn't imagine hurting someone else like that. I didn't get it. So the only way I could cope was I had an eating disorder called bulimia. It's when you eat food, a lot of food, and then you go and you make yourself throw up, binging and purging. And I started at 12 years old in seventh grade, and it consumed my life. I ended up doing it for 12 long years. I was pretty much like a prisoner to it. And the sad part is, when I was that age, I was never overweight. I wasn't an overweight kid. It wasn't about that. It was about I couldn't control something that I knew was wrong. I could see the bigger picture. And I didn't know how to help at that age. So I took it out on myself. I did the best I could. I became involved in every sport I played. I cheered for every guy's sport. I did every club you can imagine. That's one advantage of being a small school. But I thought if I could be in all these things, then maybe I can in some small way make things a little better and include people because there was all kinds of different people in each group. So then I would be able to rotate around and really try to help people feel like they belonged and they mattered. So I did the best that I could, but it's just a drop in the bucket. I kept telling myself, okay, I'm just going to get through middle school. I'm going to get to high school, and then guess what? We're just all going to go through this hormonal thing. It'll be fine. It's going to even out. Everybody's going to be nice, and we're going to get along and empower each other. Didn't happen. You know that. So I dealt with it all through high school. By the time I got to my graduation, I was so excited. I could not wait to get out of town and start a new life where for sure we've all grown up and gotten our act together in college, right? And embrace and empower each other. And that's when we're going to get stuff done. Let's do this already, right? Yes, as you know, that is not the way it happened. So I continued this bulimia pattern to help me cope with. Erica kept trying to change things so that everybody could, you know, fit in and we could be productive, but it just wasn't enough. So I kept that bad pattern up, bulimia. I got through college. I met my husband in college, and we've been together 25 years this year, and he's the best thing that's ever happened. God love him, because nobody else could probably put up with me. He has been a blessing in so many ways. That was the best thing about college, was really meeting him. And I thought, okay, this is awesome. Now I'm going to be married, and I'm going to be out of college. I'm going to start my career as a nurse, and we're going to make friends as couples. And couples, surely adults are grown up. They're not going to have any tolerance for this stuff. And we're going to like empower each other and have powwows and get things done. And you know, we can raise kids together and our kids can play and it can just be this awesome experience like I know it's supposed to be. I was so excited. Do you think that happened? It didn't happen. Not only that, I remember when my oldest, who's a senior this year, when he had his first day of kindergarten, and we had just moved to a new town, we were all sitting at our little neighborhood bus stop waiting for the kindergarten bus to come to pick up the kids for their first day. And I was so excited because I thought, okay, this is awesome. New women, they're going to be nice people, friends, kids. It's going to be great. So we're all sitting there with our kids in tow. Everyone's drinking their coffee and visiting, and I'm the new kid on the block. The parents started talking about each other, or the person down the street, gossiping. And all the little kids are sitting here looking at their parents and listening. They're not holding back. The kids are hearing all of the negative, derogatory things that the parents are saying about other people's kids. The kids know. And I just felt sick. I really thought I was going to pass out and throw up at the same time. I finally realized, I've been living this little bubble in my head, that I finally realized, I get it. Now I get it. We say kids are so mean, blah, blah, blah. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. I'm telling you right now, I've seen it. It's really sad. People just might want to look in the mirror. At that point, the bulimia that I had for 12 years, I switched to something to cope instead of bulimia, and it was a diet pill. Again, I was not overweight, but I didn't think I was good enough. I didn't think I fit in. I had spent so many years in this kind of a pattern thinking, okay, it's me, it's me. If I just change, if I just do this better, if I just work harder, it's got to be me because God loves me the way I am. But you know what? That isn't working for everyone else. And if everyone else doesn't see me, then it's got to be me. I've got to change. So I started taking a drug called phentermine. It is a doctor prescription, class 4 narcotic. So technically, you are only supposed to be getting it when you go in and see your doctor once a month. The average to be on it is 3 months. It's a short-term designed drug to help with weight loss. Somebody want to guess how long I was on it? Who said 9? 9 years. 3 months. 9 years. Problem. Side effects of this drug are you're not hungry and can't sleep really well. So a lot of times you have a hard time getting to sleep at night. You can't really eat. It makes you feel sick. Heart palpitations, lung problems. The list is very long. Go look it up if you're ever bored. Try doing that for 9 years. I was a good time to live with, I'm sure. My poor husband, Tanya, he's one of a kind. I hid it. He had no idea. No one knew. I went from one dirty little secret of bulimia right to a diet pill. I thought it was relief because I couldn't be bulimic anymore. I was exhausted. I had broken blood vessels all in my eyes. I had scars on my knuckles. I couldn't function like this, and I was hiding it. That the pill was a relief, and actually, why shouldn't I be on it? One of my coworkers recommended it. It was the thing to do, and I just, you know, wanted to lose that 10 pounds. I didn't realize that it would be my new dirty little secret. In my book, there's a very big story about that that is very important with the doctor that prescribed it to me. It really helps you to understand through my journey, it's really important for all of us to learn as we learn to really love ourselves for who we are. Mind, body, and spirit balancing in our lives and ourselves, we really need to learn to become our own self-advocates. And I go into that a lot in the book, and I explain it. And the only reason why I know it, I should have known it because I'm a nurse and I learned it, but I had to live it to really be able to do it. The doctor that prescribed the pills, this is a very important part. I was on these pills for 9 years and hiding it from my husband, who at the time was growing a company and was very busy. I was staying at home with my kids at the time, they were little. And so he would go to work at like 5 in the morning and many nights wouldn't get home till midnight or 1. And he did the best he could, but he was so tired. I was really good at hiding my symptoms, so I would be in bed when he came home till he fell asleep, and then I would have to get up, go downstairs, because what started happening towards the end of the 9 years to me, I would be doing things and all of a sudden my lungs weren't cooperating. My lungs knew how to open since I was born. It's just something you do, you don't even think about it. But my brain was like forgetting all of a sudden how to tell my lungs, open, open. I remember thinking constantly, oh my gosh, my lungs aren't opening. I can't get them to open. And I would have to jump up and down to get my lungs to open, and I'd feel them opening. But when I would lay down at night to try to rest, because I desperately needed to rest, I could feel my heart pumping so hard and slow, it just couldn't do it anymore, and my lungs closing. And I kept telling myself, okay, God, I know I can't do this anymore. I know that it's hurting me. I can't deny it. I'm going to do something about it. Really soon I am, I promise. Kept bargaining with God. It's a thing where if anybody's ever been on anything that's addictive, I hadn't. And so until you've been there, it's kind of hard to describe, but it was a thing where I didn't think that I could live without it, even though it was killing me. And what's more embarrassing is I'm a nurse. I know all the medical stuff. So I know what the side effects are. I know what's going on, and this is not okay, and you should not be doing this for 9 years. It's embarrassing, but it's important to talk about because it controlled my life. My husband finally came home one day after work and seeing me, oh my gosh, you know, are you okay? You're really tired. Are you not getting a nap when the kids are? Do you need help? Like, I'm fine, it's okay. I wanted everything to be, you know, perfect and everything. And I said, no, no, it's okay. So finally one day he could tell it wasn't okay. I just, obviously, I was, if you can imagine, you know, not eating or sleeping for that long. I didn't look great. And he said, okay, here's the deal. You haven't had a break for a long time. I can't remember the last time you went on a girl's getaway or whatever. Call your best friend. Well, I had one friend. I couldn't stand being around all the petty stuff, so I was pretty much a homebody. But she lived in a different state. And so why don't you guys go? Just get out of town. And I just want you to rest, Eric. I want you to rest, sleep, whatever it is you need to do. Go for 3 days. And then when you come home, I need you to be able to take care of the kids. So I did that. I knew I didn't feel good, but I did it. Telling myself, okay, this is what I need. I need this break, and I'm going to rest. I'm going to do exactly what he said, and I'm going to listen. Then I think I'm going to figure out how I can get off this drug. My best friend, it was really easy to hide it from her because she lived in a different state. We only got to see each other like once a year if we were lucky. I was pretty good at giving a show that everything is okay. She was so excited because she was like me, a stay-at-home mom, and she wanted a break. Well, she chose Vegas, so I did not know better because I had not been there. And I didn't realize that you don't sleep a lot in that town. And they pump oxygen in a lot of those hotels, which I found out too. So it just keeps you going. We went to Vegas, and instead of relaxing and sleeping a lot and going to the spa, we were shopping constantly. We were going to the shows at night, and they had the oxygen in the hotel, and we just kept on going and going and going. And so we were up late, and I was living on nothing. I really don't even know how I did it, but I put up a show, and then every time she would fall asleep, I would wait for her to fall asleep, and then I would have to get up, and I couldn't lay down. At this point, it was so bad, I knew. I was pleading with God. I knew that I wouldn't wake up. I knew if I let myself fall asleep, my lungs would stop working and my heart would stop working. They just couldn't do it anymore. So I told God, I said, okay, just get me home and then I'll tell Derek and I will get help and I will get off this. So we went our separate ways. I made it through the weekend and I flew back to Kansas City by myself because she was flying home to Denver. And it was a nighttime evening flight, and I wasn't used to flying in or out of Vegas. And they have wind currents or whatever you call them going into Vegas. There's a wind pattern that happens sometimes there. It happened, and I didn't feel like that was normal. So I was in the plane, and we went through a really bad windstorm that turned into lightning. It got very silent on the plane, and it was so bad that I knew that the plane was going to crash. I could feel it. I looked around at everybody. People were crying. I remember the people on the aisle next to me, because there wasn't a lot of people. Nobody really wants to go to Kansas. So there was not a lot of people on the plane that late at night. But they were a pregnant couple, and I remember them crying and holding each other. I mean, it was the worst thing I've ever been. There was lightning all over, and I swear it like hit the wing, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, we're going to die. And now I just told God, before I got on the plane, I'm going to go home, I'm going to get off the medicine. And so here's me. I'm like, okay, there's no way. I am not going to die. This is not going to happen. So what do? I cry out, God, help me, on the plane, and everybody's looking at me. I don't want to die. God, help me. So I thought the plane was crashing. And as soon as I cried out, I saw one of the airline stewardesses, and she was not happy. And you got to remember, here's another thing. Do you know when this happened? This happened a year after 9/11. Lady on plane, God help me. They landed planes back then because there were so many suspicious things. They took everything seriously. So the minute I cried out, even though I was the only one to cry out that I didn't want to die, that airline stewardess made her way back. In all the turbulence, she was hanging on to the seats, made her way back to me, sat down right beside me in the seat, buckled in. And she said, here. And she's got a piece of paper and a pen. And she said, write a letter to God. You need help. She wasn't happy. And I thought, can you see? Kansas woman lands plane. My God. Oh, my poor kids. But anyway, I owe my life to this airline stewardess. I'm going to tell you that it was the only thing that kept me calm. As soon as I did what she said and I just focused, and something planted me as I chose to focus. And I started writing a letter to God. It's in my book. I kept it. Dear God and children. And in this letter, I pleaded with God. My kids, best thing that ever happened to me is being a mom. They didn't deserve a mom that was doing that. I couldn't imagine in that moment never being able to see them, their faces again in person. I couldn't imagine what that would be like. And I wrote in that letter, God, I will do anything. I will work for you if you let me live. Please don't let this plane crash. I just want to see my kids again. Careful what you say to God, by the way. I wrote a letter, contract. And I said at the end, are you there, God? Are you listening? I'll sign the contract. And I signed my name. I made a contract with God. Wrote the letter. As soon as I was done with the letter, the airline stewardess had plenty to say to me. And it was really a great thing, because what ended up happening, it was like 2.5-hour flight. She sat with me the whole way. She ended up being this amazing, beautiful woman who was nice to me. I was so thankful. It was this really beautiful relationship happening of empowering and loving each other that I had not had the chance to experience for so long. So I was very, very thankful and grateful. And when she could tell at the very end, the captain said, stewardess, we need to take your seat. Getting ready to land for Kansas City. She sat with me the whole way until that was said. I just thanked her and gave her a hug, and she went back up to take her seat with everybody else. I would not have made it without her. I was so thankful. And I just told God, the whole time I was sitting there as we're landing, thank you, God, so much. Yes, I will work for you. I will do it tomorrow. I'll tell my husband about the pills, and I will get started right away. So I decided, I want to thank her and get her phone number, because this is way more than just somebody being nice. I want to do something nice for her. And so I waited till the very end when everybody was getting off. I made my way to the front, two airline stewardesses cleaning up the trash. But they weren't the two that I... Where was the lady that came and sat by me? It wasn't these two ladies. And I just said, excuse me, the really beautiful blonde stewardess, where is she at? And they both had brown hair. And they're like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, the one that had to come, I almost had to land the plane. I'm the loud lady, I'm so sorry, that was screaming out. And I said, she was nice, she came and sat with me. I couldn't have done that without her. She said, lady, you need to go home and go to bed. And they just kept picking the trash. So you tell me who that was. That's God. That's what he does. I am absolutely overwhelmed that she was an angel in my eyes. I was overwhelmed. I was humbled. I knew I needed to get to business. And at the same time, I was fighting these physiologic symptoms of my body completely shutting down. I had drove myself to the airport, which is about a 45-minute drive back to my house. And at this point, it was like midnight or something. It was late. And it was a rainstorm in Kansas City. There was no way that I could drive myself home. I thought I was going to pass out. I didn't feel good. One of my lungs was having a really bad problem. I didn't know how I was going to sit down long enough without being able to jump up and down in a car when you're trying to drive yourself home. How am I going to do all this? I didn't think I could do it. And I said, God, okay, if you want me to work for you, you're going to have to get me home. I can't do this. I can't call my husband. I was too embarrassed. He said, you have to help me. And he did. God talked to me all the way home. I don't remember how I got home. But I just remember just being terrified that I was going to end up in an accident and hurt someone else. And I said, God, please don't let that happen. Just please. Then my next recollection is as I'm pulling up in my driveway at my house. And I walk in the door. I pull myself together as best as I can. And my husband is there. And the kids were already in bed because it was so late. He looked at me and he's like, really? You could tell I did not get any rest. And I think he was expecting me to come home and be like, Superwoman, ready to go again. Here I am. But it wasn't like that. He was like, oh my God, like you are worse than when I sent you and I need to work tomorrow. I just started crying. Like, oh my gosh, I'm sorry. I tried to rest. I don't feel good. I'm okay, but you know. And I had an opportunity to tell him the truth. I made a deal with God, but I don't know why. It was my ego. I couldn't tell him. I didn't want him to be disappointed in me and the secret that I had. And I couldn't do that to him. He had worked so hard for our family. I lied to him. I just said, you know what, I'm so sorry. I just didn't get enough rest. We rested, we did everything, but I just didn't get enough. I couldn't go to sleep. And at this point, he was so upset with me. He was staying up with me. He was going to wait for me to go to sleep first to make sure that I would get rest. Well, that didn't work because I wasn't used to that habit. I was used to him falling asleep and not worrying, but now he's going to call me out on it and see what I'm going to do. I can't sleep. He's like, why can't you go to bed? She said, I don't know. You know, I just don't feel so well. I think it might be the flu or something. I can't. I'm sorry. Another couple hours of doing this, it was like 5 a.m, and my kids would be getting up an hour later. And you know what that's like? They have a radar. If you're in the house, they're going to find you. Our house wasn't that big. He said, you know what? I don't want the kids to see you like this. You're in no condition. I don't know what's wrong with you. You're not telling me something. He goes, have it your way. You have to take rest. There was a new hotel that had just opened up by our house. It wasn't even a mile away. And he said, go to that hotel, and I want you to sleep. And I don't want you to call me. I want you to sleep all day. I will take care of the kids when you come home, and we're going to talk. We're going to figure out what's going on. You're going to tell me. I was humiliated. I was embarrassed. He was right. I should have come clean. Instead, I did what he said. When I got in the car, I prayed again. I said, God, I cannot drive this car. I don't feel good. Please help me. I'll just go to the hotel, like Derek said, and get rest, and I'll feel better, and then I'll tell him after I have rest. So I drove to the hotel up the street. I got out of my car. I was really dizzy. I got into the check-in place, and I said, I need a room. And the man looked at me, and he said, I'm really sorry, ma'am. I can tell that you're tired. There's no room at the inn. I just started bawling the poor guy. And so then he just started looking up a few other hotels for me to help me because he felt so bad. And he was trying to explain to me, well, go down to this one down the street or whatever. But at this point, I was so dizzy, I couldn't even process what he was saying. It was like, blah, 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 blah. And I just waited for him to finish, and I just said, thank you, and I left. I got in my car, and I said, oh, my God, I can't do this. I don't even know what he said. I don't know where to go. I need help, God, please. Well, I got in my car, and I started driving, and I just knew I was supposed to go this way. I drove right past a hospital emergency room. It would have been so easy for me to go there. And I remember knowing, I need to go there. But I didn't. I kept on going to the nearest hotel that I could think in my head that it would be. I remember coming to this little tiny rundown hotel, different from any that I've stayed at before. It only had 15 to 20 rooms. I remember pulling into the parking lot, and despite all of these physical manifestations I was having, my body's like shutting down and I'm having problems and I think I'm going to pass out, I remember paying attention to the license plates parked in the parking lot. Not one license plate was the same, a different state. And I remember thinking, that's really interesting. This is Kansas City. It's not a big place. Not a lot of people come for a lot of different things. So I thought that was odd. I parked my car, and again, I said a prayer, God, please help me get into the hotel and checked in, and I will take rest like my husband said. Then I will go back, and I'll tell him that I need help. I'm going to get off that drug. So I go to check in. You know, I said, I need a room, and the man said, sure, no problem, and he's setting up a room for me. And he's trying to explain to me how to get to my room, but it was like blah, 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 blah. I was so dizzy, I didn't feel well. And then something caught my attention. I looked down, and there was a newspaper sitting on the counter. And I remember the newspaper headlines was something about a terrorist. Remember, again, this was a year anniversary after 9/11. These are important things. The 24 hours that I'm telling you about before I died are really important things. It's about fear. It's about ego. It's about faith. Here's the deal. Up to this point, starting at 12 years old with bulimia, I started doing something different. I was shifting. I was operating in the ego. So I would make choices based on what was acceptable to mankind, which is opposite of God. I was operating in ego, out of fear. That's what was driving a lot of my decisions. Fear of not being accepted. List goes on. So 24 hours before I died, I had to live these things that would really seem impossible to me because of my physical manifestations at the time to even function. God was starting to do a pattern when I checked into this hotel of making me have a ego mankind choice or a faith choice and having to make a decision over and over again in a split second. And it started by looking at that newspaper. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is really strange. All the license plates in the hotel. At this time, there had been some things on the news on and off that were in our town about how in Kansas City, it was one of the places that there was some flight training done for some terrorist stuff. And so that was kind of going through my mind a little bit. I get the key. I have no idea where I'm going. Just handed me a card. Didn't have a room number on it. And he was trying to talk to me, but I wasn't listening, remember? So I had no idea where I was going. So I just thanked him. I was too embarrassed. And you walked out the door from the office. It was like all open courtyard. And then you had to like go up a few steps, depending on which room was yours. And it was almost like little apartments. My key didn't have a room number on it. And I was halfway through the courtyard, and I couldn't remember what my room number is. And at this point, I thought, okay, I'm going to pass out right here in the middle of the courtyard. I've got this far, and I'm dying. God, please help me just find my room. Please, God. So I decided I was going to try the very first room that was closest to me because I just needed to sit down and I was going to give it a shot. I didn't know what else to do. I couldn't remember. So I walk up the stairs. I slide my card so that it will blink green to let me in. And of course, it doesn't blink green. It blinks red, which means it's not your room. I just lost it. I began crying. I turned around and I sat on the steps. I didn't know what else to do. There was, you know, too many other rooms and I didn't have it in me. Then the door opened, and I thought, oh my God, now I have to apologize to these poor people. They probably think I'm trying to break in and, you know, that I need help or whatever. And I turned to go to apologize to the people. And, wow, I grew up spending a lot of time with my grandparents, and when I'd stay at their house, they had this picture of Jesus in their spare bedroom that I stayed in. I didn't expect to turn around and be apologizing to Jesus. It was him. I'll never forget his eyes. He didn't say anything to me, but he just walked past me. He put his hand up like this, and I knew. It was like this telepathic communication of someone I'd always known. Not only did I hand him my room key, he walked down the stairs and he starts walking across the courtyard with purpose, like he knew exactly where my room was. But remember, the card does not have a room number on it. Now, what's kind of embarrassing about this is I have kids that I've taught since they were little to not go with strangers. Never. So here I am. Not only am I following a stranger, technically, I gave him my room key. So without hesitation, I had this energy to follow someone I'd always known. Almost in a trance. It was so natural. So I followed him all the way across the courtyard, right up without hesitation, and sure enough, he puts it in the key thing, and it blinks green. And he opened the door, and he said, come. So, what do? I walk into the room, I invite him in, and I shut the door. Is that a ego, logical, man-choice thing to do that we're taught? Invite a stranger in today. Or is it a faith choice? Be quiet and listen, Erica. We're here to help you. I am Jesus. Really hard, again, but I had a split second, and I knew all those years, the things I was doing, listening to man, it wasn't working. I was dying. I made choices based on those things instead of listening to God, like I did when I was a child. I had had it with listening to man. I was ready to listen to God because I didn't want to die. So I made that decision. Yes, I invited him in. Yes, the door closed. And when it did, he looked at me and he said, "Take rest." And I knew he meant business, and I had a choice to do that or not. So he left. I just started crying, "Thank you, God, so much. Oh, my gosh. I'm definitely going to take rest." Well, I went to sit down to take off my shoes and things. My darn lungs again were giving me a problem. I thought, well, okay, you want me to take rest, but you need to help me with this. I can't sit down even now. It's so bad I can't even sit for a few seconds to get my shoes off. My lung is not opening, and my heart, I could feel it. I thought I was going to pass out. And I just had an idea, okay, if I take a bath really quick and get my mind off of it, I can relax, and then I'll take rest. I'll do what Jesus said. I run the bath, I get my shoes off, I take my rings off, get my keys, purse, everything off of me, and I'm listening to the bath water running. And I look at the counter. On the counter in there, they had that newspaper. It was the same headlines again. I remember looking at the headlines and hearing the water running, and my head started spinning. Terrorist. Kansas City training, flight training, whatever. Thinking about the news bulletins that have been on, everything started flooding about 9/11. And all at once, my ego man took over again out of fear. And the ego said, "Oh my gosh, are you kidding me? That wasn't Jesus. Wake up. Hello. That was a stranger. Stranger danger. You let them in. That stranger is a terrorist. Don't you remember all the license plates? They were all different. Did you not think that was strange? This is Kansas. No one wants to come here. That was a terrorist, and the reason why the terrorist was helping you, is what you thought, to lay down, take rest, is because, don't you remember what was in his hand? That this person that I thought was Jesus had a brown little paper bag, like a lunch bag from way back when, you had little lunch sacks brown in his hand. Oh, you're right, it couldn't have been Jesus, because why would he have a brown paper lunch sack? It was a bomb. It had to be a bomb, because that's fear, ego, that was the logical thing. I was crazy to think it was Jesus. I mean, come on. He had a bomb, and he wanted me to take rest, because guess what? He wanted me to be there when he blew up the hotel so that I would perish. So I started to panic big time. And then I heard a voice when I was panicking, and it was God, and he said, "Go now. Leave everything behind and follow me if you want to live." And I knew that voice. It was the same voice that was with me when I was in kindergarten that day. It's the same voice that I listened to for so many years until I started stifling God's voice and listening to man. And so I listened. There was no hesitation. I was going with what God said. Because every time I did in the past, I started looking at it. It was never wrong. And I had it all wrong all those years. So I remember looking on the counter and thinking, oh my gosh, I have to grab my ring. I have to grab my keys to my new BMW. I've got to put my shoes. I don't have a license on. I have nothing. And he said, "Where you're going, can't bring it with you." And I knew I had to make a split-second decision. I didn't have time to analyze anything. It was go now. So I left it all behind. I even left the water running. And I remember feeling terrible, thinking, oh my God, I hope that doesn't cause a mess for those people, but I can't help it. God said, "Go now, I'm going." So I left the water running in the tub, shoes, keys, everything. I left it behind. I went running out of the hotel as fast as I could because a bomb was going to go off in the hotel. I ran away from the hotel, the only direction possible at that point. They were tarring parking lot of a civic center where we have, like, you know, auditorium, different kind of convention things. They were paving that parking lot, but I had to run across. It was the only way to go, and it was hot tar. I didn't have shoes on, so that worked not very well, but I made it work because a bomb was going to go off, and I didn't want to die. So I went running through it. There was three construction workers at the time with a little steamroller, and they were sitting there taking a smoke break. And they looked at me, and one of them says, "Hey, lady, do you need help?" And I stopped for just a second, and I looked at them, and I thought, oh, my God, I've got to help them. I've got to tell them what's going on because they're going to blow up. They're way too close to the hotel. I said, "Yes." I said, "You know what? You've got to come now. Leave everything. Go with me. There's someone that's going to have a bomb go off in that hotel." Now, remember, this is a year after 9/11. So they looked at me, and they just had this blank look, all of them, on their face at first, and they were quiet for what seemed like forever. And then one of them all of a sudden just started laughing, and then the other ones laughed, and they just started laughing at me. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, I feel horrible. I didn't do a good enough job to help them see, and they're going to die now, and it's my fault. And I remember hearing God's voice, and he said to me, "Erica, it's free will. Go now." And my heart hurt so bad. My legs felt like lead, and my feet hurt, but I knew I had to go and get away. and listen. So I took off running again. I got through the parking lot and I got to the intersection. And I don't know if any of you have ever played that game Frogger. It was a game really popular way back when. I was kind of like that frog that hops between the traffic and not getting ran over by the cars. I didn't have time to wait. I knew that the hotel would blow up, and so I dodged all the cars, and I did a really good job till I got to the fourth lane of traffic, and a car came, like, literally, like, right here to me without hitting me. The car pulled up, and it had no paint on the car. Honestly, don't even know how the car was running. It looked like it was in really bad shape, and a man got out, and he was absolutely beside himself, and he was speaking Spanish, and I broke in English. I didn't know what he was saying, but he was very visibly shaken. And he said, "Lady, you need help." I needed help, and at this time I didn't have a choice. He was my only help to get away. He motioned for me to go in his side of the passenger seat and get in. And as I'm walking over to the car, again, I said, "God, the human logical choice would not be get in a car with a stranger." I mean, I've got dirt on my feet, no shoes. I pretty much look like I could be taken advantage of. Logical, don't do it. Faith. Get in the car, you need help. I said, "God, you have to give me a sign that I know that this is what you want me to do." I get over to the side of the car, I open the door, and there was a Bible sitting in the seat, passenger seat. So what happened next was this poor man was only trying to turn into the hotel I was running from to get his paycheck because he was one of the cleaning people. And he was there on a green card. And I didn't know that at the time, but says to me, "I will take you. I need to get my check first." And I said, "Oh, no, we can't go that way." I said, "You need to listen to me." I said, "We can't go over there." And he stops for a second, and I said, "Rodolfo, listen to me now." I said, "This is not this person you see, but God is giving you a message. He sees your heart, and if you have faith, you will leave everything, and you will do what I say. You will be rewarded." And he looked at me in shock. And then I said, "Rodolfo, I know that you are working hard because your wife has cancer and she's in Mexico and this money has to get to your lawyer by a certain time. I get it. Because otherwise she won't get the health care that she needs. But you need to leave everything and trust God." Now, number one, I did not know this man's name. I didn't know anything about him but here. I just told him all this stuff. It wasn't me. God works in many ways. It's up to us to be quiet and listen and discern those messages. And he just started crying and shaking because he knew there was no way I could know this. He picked up his little tiny cell phone and he called somebody. I didn't know who it was. And he said, "Pastor, I have this woman. Bring her." I didn't know it at the time, but it was his pastor he had called. And the pastor said, "Bring her to the church." He was really close to his church. So he made a U-turn and he drove up to the top of the hill a couple blocks away. And the pastor had called 911 in the meantime. And the paramedics were on their way. He pulled into the parking lot. Couldn't get out of the car. And the pastor was a big man. He was over 6 feet tall. He came. And Rodolfo and the pastor helped me on each side and carried me into the church to wait for the paramedics. And he had a little tiny office there by the doorway. He sat me down in the chair, and Rodolfo sat in the other chair beside me, and the pastor sat at his desk. At this point, Rodolfo was hysterical, and he was crying, and he was doing broken English with Spanish, and he was trying to say, "This woman, and she said this, and God is with her," and all this stuff. And the pastor's looking at me, and he can tell that I'm probably not going to be around much longer. It was pretty bad, and I was going to lose consciousness. And he said, "Child, look at me. What is your name?" I couldn't remember my name. "Who are you? Do you have family?" I had no identification on me. I didn't have shoes on. I did not know my family. I blanked out. I did not know anything. And he looked into my eyes, and all of a sudden, he just jumped out of his chair at his desk across from me, and he slammed his fist like that. He looked at me, he knew in that moment I was going to die. And he said to me, "Child, do you believe in God? I see it in your eyes, and I know where you're going." And I remember thinking, I cannot get out of this chair, and my lungs aren't opening, I'm done. And all of a sudden, there was a force that just propelled me up and out of my seat, and I said, "I believe in God." And that's when I died. I died right then and there in the pastor's office, the church. And I remember that moment, what I learned, painful and horrible and whatever, it actually wasn't. For the first time in my life, I could breathe. I could really breathe. And it was exhilarating and wonderful. It wasn't terrible and awful. It wasn't painful in the least. And I remember coming out of my body and seeing this, which I knew it was my body. It was my shell. that wasn't really me, and I knew it for the first time. I remember watching at the ceiling and knowing, this is me, and it's amazing and wonderful. It's the most amazing feeling. I'm finally me. And I remember this tunnel of light, just going into it. It was so easy. It wasn't anything I had to sign up to do or know how to do or learn to do. It was just a part of me, and it knew me and enveloped me. And I remember looking down and looking at Rodolfo, the man that had helped me, and asking, can he come too? I don't know why to this day I had that question. I don't know why. I was so thankful for what he did. And I knew this feeling where I was going, that it was somewhere that was familiar and I wanted to be, and I wanted him to come because he was a good person too. And I remember hearing a voice to the right, it's not his time. And so with that, I just smiled at myself laying there, and I saw the paramedics coming in at that point, and I just let go. This is very hard at this point to describe, and I'm going to do my best, the magnitude of everything I experienced. The tunnel had a life of its own, and it was the most incredible, powerful, beautiful, exhilarating love. There was so much unconditional love, and it just filled me, and it propelled me effortlessly. I didn't have to do anything. I went through this beautiful tunnel, and I finally got to the top of the tunnel, and time did not exist at all. So what we think about time here is not like that at all on the other side. I get to the top of the tunnel and I was delivered into the hand of God. God was so great I could not see his hands like you and I see hands, but I could feel them all around me. And God and I stood together and heaven was right behind us. And we're looking out at the galaxy and all the stars and the beauty and the brilliance. And God was on my right. And I remember hearing all of a sudden this familiar noise in my left ear, and it was like a vintage sounding movie projector. And I remember hearing that noise like a movie was starting, 3, 2, 1, and then all of a sudden the stars like align themselves like a movie curtain. And I'm thinking, oh my God, it's like God and me, and we're in a movie theater, and the stars are like the curtain, and the curtain starts parting and going across to reveal a movie screen. That noise in the projector, 3, 2, 1, and then on the screen it said, the life review of Erica McKenzie. And there I was as a baby. And I saw everything from the day I was born until that day that I died. This is where it gets really interesting for me. It was hard for me to comprehend because all these things that I saw in this life review, these things were deemed important, significant, man's view. So they were things like losing a tooth, getting an award for the spelling bee, graduating from eighth grade, getting a basketball award, lettering in this, all these awards and things that I had received throughout my whole life. And they were good things. They were milestones. It wasn't like they were bad, you know, becoming a mom, getting married. These things, they were good things. And I felt a lot of love through this whole experience. But what was interesting is I was getting to the end of this life review till that day that I died. I had not seen anything negative yet, and I hadn't been judged. But I grew up learning I was a sinner, and that God would judge me. I knew I wasn't perfect. I had made so many mistakes. So God, technically, would judge me, right? Why didn't he? I kept waiting. I should have been judged. I was not perfect. I messed up so much. All I kept feeling the whole time was this amazing, unconditional love pouring in, so much so that I didn't think I could take on any more love. I didn't know how I was going to do it. We get to the very end of that review, not judged, but God said to me, now look. And guess what happened? At the same time that he said, now look, appeared in front of me eyeglasses. At that point, I had never worn glasses in my life. I didn't need them. And these were not usual glasses. These were the size of a vehicle. Oh my gosh, there's no way I can put these glasses on. They're the size of a vehicle. How am I going to fit them on my face? As I'm thinking that thought, I'm finding that my hands are just reaching towards the glasses. I grab the glasses, I pull them and draw them near to my face, and by the time I got them to my face, guess what? They fit perfectly, like a glove. With God, all things are possible. So, I have glasses on, and God says, now look, so what do you think happened? I hear that vintage-sounding projector again. There's my name again, life review of Erica McKenzie. I got 2 life reviews. I was very nervous because I was sure that I was going to be judged. And I waited, and it started again from the day I was born, and went through these series of events to the day I died. But this time, I didn't see anything that I had seen the first time. Does anybody want to guess what I saw?
Other people.
Okay, good. This time, I saw all the things that I had done, but it was acts of kindness and love. Things I didn't even remember. Being somebody's friend when everybody else wouldn't. Giving a homeless person money when I didn't have money to give. Helping an elderly person brush their hair at the rest home. I mean, there were so many things I couldn't even remember that I did these things. But there was no negative things. But remember, I am not perfect. I messed up so much. So why did I not see that again? What I saw my entire life was all of these things with love and kindness and caring and helping and compassion. And God said to me, these are the things that matter. So that second life review, I was shown all the things that matter to God. And the first life review, I was shown all the things that matter to mankind. Two different things. Ego, faith. Man, God. Very important lessons. You get to the end of that life review, and all of my questions that I would have come to my mind, it was like this telepathic communication between God and I. As soon as I would think a thought at all, it didn't matter what it was, I was getting the answers downloaded to me. And the whole entire time that happened, this unconditional love was encompassing it. And God had his arms around me and I could feel him. It was the most wonderful feeling. And we got to the day that I died, I still was not judged. And yes, I'm going to say that until it's driven home. Because it's so important. We get to the end of that life review. And then another lesson started. And I call this one the rippling effect. And again, God was on my right side. And I remember looking, and this is the only time that I got to see any physical manifestation of God. And the only explanation I can give for what I saw is that what I learned and that experience in heaven was that God shows and tells each and every one of us exactly what we are to know and see at that time, because it's part of his plan. And so I saw his fingers, his hand, his arm, all the way up to here. And it was the size of a semi-truck. And I watched him, his arm went up with purpose, and his fingers went past the highest stars. I couldn't even see it anymore. And I remember him putting his hand and rotating it so his palm was flat. And as I'm looking at his palm, in it appeared the largest single rock, bigger than the biggest boulder that you guys probably have in your mountains. And I remember looking at it, and as I'm looking at it, it starts glowing this incredible light. I am the rock. I am the light. The light is of me, and I'm with you. And as he said that, then he let loose the rock. God and I watching it together, and it felt like a lifetime that we're watching this rock fall. And as it's falling and it's getting closer to right in front of me, I remember thinking, oh my gosh. And he said, you are the rock. You are the light. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I'm the rock. I'm the light. And it's falling now right down below us. And then right below us, all of a sudden appeared the largest body of water. It was so large that I couldn't even see the borders of the water, but it was completely still. And we watched this rock, and it fell into this huge body of water. And this rock made one single ripple. That was it, one powerful single ripple. And he said to me, you are the rock, you are the light, you are the ripple. What do you think the water was? Mankind, yeah, very good. Mankind, he said, you are the ripple that affects mankind. Do you think that was just for Erica? No, not at all. Each and every one of us are the rock. Each and every one of us within are the light. The light is of our Creator, and our Creator is always with us. And yes, each and every one of us significantly have the power to affect mankind. It's true. I saw it. The lessons continued. And there were a lot of lessons, and I won't be able to share them all tonight, but the next one I do want to share with you is about the gifts. And I remember God saying to look again, and again I was to look to my right, and this time the stars, they parted, and behind the stars were shelves, like bookshelves, white, brilliant shelves that took on a life of their own. And I remember looking at these shelves, and I'm like, my gosh, they're like going all the way past like all these planets and galaxies. And then I remember knowing I had to look this way. So I look behind me and I'm like, oh my gosh, they're like going all the way that way. And I can't even see them anymore. They were so long and there were so many. Oh my gosh, they're going past the highest star. I can't even see them. There's so many shelves. And then all of a sudden on all the shelves, what do you think I saw? Anybody know? Gifts, presents, like at Christmas. If there's that many shelves and it goes on for that long, there's gifts and presents. Guess what? They filled each and every one of those shelves. All the space, there was no space available for anything because they were filled. And not one gift, not one, was the same. And I remember looking for quite some time trying to figure out, okay, where's another one that looks like similar or whatever? Not one. They were all amazing, beautiful gifts. And then God said to me, Erica, when each and every one of you are born, I give each and every one of you gifts. And they're all different because it's part of my plan. And as you go through life, I have more gifts for each and every one of you. And all you have to do, you have to ask. Asking comes with being prepared, with being quiet and listening. I can't tell you how many times God has told me to be quiet and listen in this whole experience I had, and it is so important. And he said, Erica, when you were born, I gave you the gift of patience, and I gave you the gift of beauty. Now, I grew up respecting my elders, and I was pretty much a rule follower. So this was very not like myself, but I did it. I kind of argued with God a little bit. I said, no, God, that can't be right. You didn't give me the gift of beauty because, see, everything I did in my life, the series of events that led up until that day I died, I didn't think I was good enough. I didn't think I was pretty. I convinced myself that I wasn't, because if I was, people wouldn't have treated me like that. I had it all wrong. And God stopped me, and again he said, Erica, when you were born, I gave you the gift of patience, and I gave you the gift of beauty. And I understood what that meant for the first time in my life. The gift of beauty came from God, and it was in my heart. It was love. It was on the inside. It was extension. Your uniqueness is your value. Think about it. Can anybody in this room honestly tell me they know what makes up their uniqueness? Just shout it out if you do. Because I didn't know. I had to die to learn it. Uniqueness. Unique. What does that mean? It means being different than everyone, right? Makes you special, set apart. It's your gifts. People, it is your gifts. Your uniqueness is your value. And God said, your value is your contribution here on your earthly journey. Okay, that does not make sense. So my uniqueness is my value. And you just told me that my gifts were patience and beauty. So beauty was value. And okay, I'm trying to figure this out. How is that my contribution? And well, of course, it's God. He's going to be patient and, you know, work with you until you understand. And he did. And I got it. I went through my life trying to change the very gifts I got sent into this world with to be accepted, thinking then I can contribute. I had it all backwards, right? What God told me is our gifts are our blueprint. They are different, but they are necessary. It's imperative for you to use your gifts, identify and learn and grow and use them on your journey so that you can actually do things to the magnitude of why you're sent here on your mission. And it gets much deeper than that. You have to love yourself. I learned it the hard way. I loved my family. I loved others. I cared for others. But you know what? I didn't love myself. Until we can give ourselves permission to start to be able to see how valuable each and every one of us are, because we are ourselves. We can't really love ourselves. And what happens is, if you don't love yourself, and you just talk the talk, then you're never able to access those gifts to the capacity and the magnitude that they were designed to be used. And I go into more of that later, but just trust me. We get through this big lesson of the gifts and how they're to be used and why they are given. And God and I shared many more lessons. And I knew that I was finally home. You want to talk about Dorothy from Kansas knowing there's no place like home? Once you get there, you'll never forget. I was home, and I never wanted to be parted from God. How is that possible when I, not even 24 hours before, was negotiating on the airplane that was going to crash that I didn't want to leave my children? But if I wanted to stay in heaven, my children weren't there. I knew where they were. They were on earth, but I also knew at the same time they were fine, that we were all going to be together. And not only that, but I was shown there is a bridge. It exists between heaven and earth. And all of us have access to it. And if you don't think you have access to it, you call. You call Dorothy, and we'll work on it together. Please, I promise you, there's not one person on this earth that is more qualified, that you have to go to seek the answer. It's God, and is there for each and every one of you to see and grow. if you choose to grow that connection, you'll be able to see it. So God and I experienced a lot more lessons together. And the last lesson is called the New Earth. God and I were standing together again, this time looking down at Earth, admiring the Earth. And it was so far away, but yet kind of like the moon, if you see the moon on a full moon night or whatever, and it's about that far apart, but it's flip-flop, the Earth's down here, and I'm up in heaven. And I was admiring it, and I was knowing that, you know, oh gosh, my family's down there. And God said to me, he and who believes in me? And I remember like a Rolodex in my mind, like going through the people that I knew that believed in God, my friends, my family, and all that. All of a sudden, I'm looking at the Earth, and I'm admiring and knowing that I'm happy with them staying there, I'm staying here, and this is great, and everything's going to be okay. And all of a sudden, I started to see something on the planet, and I was trying to focus my eyes in to see what I, you know, what's that moving? And as soon as I had that thought of, what's that moving, what do I want to see, then it was really clear. There are flames all over the planet. It was engulfing the planet from every part of the Earth. I became terrified because my kids were down there, my family, my friends. I was thinking again of all the people I knew that were down there, and now the Earth is in flames. What does this mean? And I was panicking. Just as I was panicking, you know what appeared? Those glasses again. And the last time I put those glasses on, I had seen what I couldn't see before. And now I'm seeing flames without glasses. There was no way I was going to put the glasses on. I didn't want to see it. I didn't want to know. Sheer terror. It didn't matter. As soon as I saw the glasses, I felt my arms reaching and embracing the glasses and drawing them to my face. And yes, again, they did fit. And I remember closing my eyes thinking, okay, I'm not going to look. I'm not going to look. As soon as I had that thought, I looked. And God said, now look. Oh, my God. This is the first time that I was in heaven and I felt the sadness from God. It's so hard to put in words. The only thing I can even think, it doesn't give a weight to it, but when my firstborn was old enough to try to ride a bike, was probably too little, I didn't want him to skin his knees. I didn't want him to get hurt. There came a point I couldn't not let him learn how to ride a bike. Getting to be a little bit old, it's like, Mom, everyone else is riding their bikes. Come on. I had to get to that point with my child to let go and have this trust to let him make a decision. And I watched, and yes, he skinned his knees, but I loved him so much that I had to let him try. That's the sadness times trifold of what God felt, this incredible sadness. I'm looking and I'm thinking, okay, yes, I'm sad, but something is happening. And as I'm thinking that, I'm looking, and there's these little things that start flickering off between all of the flame. And it's like this silver white glowing beautiful lights. And I have a realization as soon as I say a silver light lights. Oh my God, they're souls. These are people. And they're fine. They're unharmed. I'm like, oh my gosh. I had the most relief I've ever felt in my life. God, it's okay. Look, God, you don't have to be sad anymore. Look, they're fine. See, they're coming. They're escaping. They're not hurt. And we watch them together, and they're lifting off effortlessly, and they're floating behind us into heaven. They were unharmed. God was more sad than ever. And I said, God, what's wrong? Can't you see? Do you need my glasses? And God said, it's free will, Erica. And I looked again, and I saw. God loves us so much. Hand in hand, he told me, with the gift of life is the gift of free will, and it's the hardest thing. It's like when I taught my little boy to ride the bike. It's the hardest thing to let him go. They're going to skin their knees and fall. But you love them so much. But there comes a point we have to let them make their own decisions. You can't force it. Those people that were left behind had chose to not have a connection with God. What do you think sustains the connection? Do you think it's money or degrees? Because it is. Just kidding, I want to see if anybody's not falling asleep yet. It's love. It is love. I mean, it is that easy, people. Yes, it's love. The connection is simple. It's about loving your Creator. And it's not about saying 25,000 Hail Marys or doing blah, 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 whatever. It is just simply having the desire to have that love and receiving the love from our Creator. It's so easy. The people had chose. It wasn't God. Blood chose to not want to have that connection. And it hurt him so much because he loved each and every one of us. And instead of being joyous for all of these thousands of souls that were going into heaven, he was crying for the ones. He couldn't force it. It was free will. He loved them that much that he let them make their choice. So the lesson ended, and I wanted to stay more than ever. And I was ready to go into heaven, and I looked behind me, and heaven was a planet. And it was so incredible. God looked at me, and he said, "Oh, you're not staying, child. You work for me now, remember?" He held me to that contract that I had wrote that day on the plane. "I work for him." "Oh, yeah, but I'm going to work for you in there." No, God had different plans for me. He said, "But before you go back, Erica, I want to give you two more gifts." He said, "I'm going to give you the gift of..." Sorry, kind of a smush ball. My kids said I need to work on that. Feels like just yesterday. School was very hard for me. I rubbed Shay Martin's head all the time because I thought it was so awesome. He was so smart. I didn't have that gift. I had lots of tutors. I had dyslexia. I had ADD. And back then, she just sort of had to try to get by. So when God said, "I'm going to give you the gift of knowledge and the gift of wisdom," I was just like, "Okay, but I'm telling you, God, right now that you're going to have to really, you know, work with me on that because that is not going to be easy for me." He said, "Now I want you to take patience, beauty, knowledge, and wisdom. And Erica, you go back. I want you to be quiet and listen to the people that I put into your life. And then when you speak, you will change millions of people's lives." I was getting ready to prepare my case and argue with God. I didn't have time by the time those thoughts came. He sent me back. And I found myself in a tunnel. This time. The tunnel was very different. The tunnel was dark. The tunnel was confining. And I was standing like this. I had no room. I couldn't see. I couldn't feel. I couldn't hear. I was alone. It was the first time in this whole experience that I felt alone and I couldn't feel God. And I'm going through this tunnel and I know that I'm going back to Earth because I work for God now. As soon as I had that knowing, I started slowing down in the tunnel and I stopped. So my thought was, Erica defected the tunnel. I'm thinking, I didn't know what he did, but God wasn't there. I couldn't hear him. I was stopped and I couldn't move. I'm stuck. How am I going to get to Earth? As soon as I'm thinking these thoughts, I hear something. So I thought, okay, I got to go with the only sense that's working of my five senses, and it was hearing. And so what it was is in my left ear, it was like this buzzing noise. It was like, I don't know if you guys had this or maybe it was just me being in the country. We only had three television channels, and like at midnight, it would go, if you still had your television set on, it would have this, you know, kind of like stuff all over the screen and make this kind of noise, like staticky. Buzzing noise, best way to describe it. And so I'm paying attention to this noise, thinking, okay, I'm just going to listen and try to figure out what this is so then I can get help because I'm stuck and I've got to get back down to Earth. So as I listen to this noise, it becomes magnified and I begin to be pulled out of the tunnel to my left and onto my back, getting closer to the noise. And I still, at this point, I can't see anything and I can't move, but I can hear and I'm following this noise. And I get to a point where I stop, and I'm just sort of hovering there on my back. The only sense that I had was hearing. I didn't know where I was. All right, I'm going to get help. I'm going to listen. As soon as I had that realization of listening, that noise turned to muffling. Have you ever been to a convention center where there's a lot of people, like hundreds of people, and everybody's having a conversation at once? So you really can't hear your own conversation going on, let alone anybody else's. That's what it was. And as soon as I had that knowing, I'm like, oh my gosh, these are people. I can't understand what they're saying, but it's muffled. As soon as I had the realization, oh my gosh, these are people, in that moment, I could understand each and every person and their conversation. And everybody was not just speaking English. There was multiple conversations in different languages happening, and I could understand all of them. And the common underlying important thing you need to know is all of these conversations were negative. Anger, sadness, negativity, hurt. And as soon as I understood that, I had the realization, oh my God, I'm at the edge of hell. As soon as I had that thought, a light went off in me and I was glowing and radiating and it's dark everywhere. And here's this light. I feel all these hands all over me. They started to pull me down because I was the only light in there. And I cried out to God because I couldn't move. God, help me. I love you. That connection. It's all about the connection. And as soon as I cried out, All the hands reluctantly had to let go of me. My body went back up, and I floated out. And as I was leaving, I cried for those people, because I couldn't take them with me. They weren't bad. How do you think those people got to hell? Do anybody know? God didn't put them there. They did. They chose separation, God. And guess what else I learned? Those people could get out at any time they want. They don't have to be prayed for, nothing. It doesn't work like that. They just simply, the connection. That's all it is. Loving God. They chose not to have that connection. So basically, I finally got back out, but that was a whole other lifetime. The whole time going back down that tunnel again, I maintained that connection with God, and I was just talking to him. I was so tired and exhausted at this point. I just wanted to take a rest. And every time I would try to rest and breathe, I would start stopping in the tunnel. I knew what that meant. If I would stop again where I was going, and this time I didn't have the energy. I didn't know if I could get out. So I talked to him the rest of the way down. That's when eventually I got to the ceiling of the emergency room, and I saw my body. It was a shell. And I was like, I'm not going in that, because I'm not going to fit. I don't even know how to process that. There was no way I could fit in that confining little thing. That's what it looked like to me. I tried to argue with God. It didn't work. So I had to go back into my body. I did. And it hurt, because I felt like I was confined. I woke up. My husband was crying over my body. I couldn't speak. I didn't have a voice. They checked me into the hospital for observation, and I was by myself. I still wasn't able to speak, to tell everybody where I had been. The next morning I woke up. The attending physician came into the room. He left the door open. I was by myself. It was just he and I. The nurse was charting the hall. So she heard everything, and he said, "Good morning, Mrs. McKenzie. How are you feeling this morning?" All of a sudden, I thought I was going to throw up everywhere. It just started coming up. But it wasn't throw up. It was my voice. I couldn't control it. And I said, "Doctor, doctor, I've just been to heaven. I've got to tell you what happened. I've been with God." As soon as I said that, he got this white look on his face. All the color was drained. He didn't even do my health assessment, and he left the room immediately, dismissed me. A couple hours later, he came back with my husband, and he said, "It's okay, Mrs. McKenzie. Your husband and I have talked, and we want the best for you. And even though you have no family history of bipolar disorder, and technically you're too old to get a late onset of bipolar disorder, you're clearly hallucinating and having bipolar disorder. You're talking about heaven. So we're going to check you into this great psychiatric program and get you the help you need. 11 medications later." And he left the room. And my husband wanted the best for me. It's not his fault. He listened to the doctor, right? I begged them. I said, "Listen, I'm sorry I didn't tell you about the phentermine. Please look up the side effects of phentermine. Try being on it for 9 years." I pleaded with him, "Let me detox. This is what happened. And I went to heaven. You have to believe me." They didn't listen. They left the room. And the nurse came in a few minutes later. She had heard everything happening, and she said, "Shh, be quiet and listen, child. I heard everything that you told that doctor when you first spoke. I've worked for that man for 7 years. And I'm so sorry that the first person that you got to tell this beautiful experience about being to heaven is an atheist. But you have to be quiet and listen, and you'll know when you can speak." I was checked into a psychiatric facility at a Rochester Mayo Clinic, which is far from Kansas, for a month away from my children, put immediately, instead of being able to detox from the phentermine and sleep, which I really needed, they didn't listen to me. And it was based on that doctor's personal belief instead of patient care and being quiet and listening. So I was there for a month away from my kids on drugs that I shouldn't have been on if you don't need them. It was a good time. So anyway, I guess we have to stop.
Thank you.